So before we get into the actual heavy lifting today, I
Yeah.
do need to mention that this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Right. I mean, they've got this full Series 63 course, and it has adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and these unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge,
It
honestly.
really is. So if you want to walk into test day with, absolute confidence, check it out at certfuel.com. Anyway, let's just jump right in.
Let's do it.
Imagine you're sitting at your desk on, I don't know, a Tuesday afternoon.
Okay.
You're an administrative assistant at a mid-sized financial firm. Your boss is out on the golf course, the phones are ringing, and a client calls in completely panicking because they want to execute a trade before the market closes.
Setting the scene, I like it.
Right. And you've seen your boss do this 1,000 times. You have the software open, you click a few buttons, you confirm the order, you save the day. You feel like a total hero.
But you're definitely not.
No. Because what you actually just did, in the eyes of state regulators, is commit a serious violation of securities law. Like the kind of thing that could permanently nuke your entire career.
It really is a terrifying reality. And honestly, it happens way more often than people think. The line between being a helpful employee and being an unregistered illegal securities agent is razor thin.
Oh, totally.
And the Uniform Securities Act is completely unforgiving if you cross that line.
And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. If you're listening to this because you're prepping for the Series 63, the definition and registration of an agent is 13% of your exam.
13%. That's massive.
It's massive. That is 8 guaranteed questions. And they don't test the easy stuff, do they?
Oh, never. They test the gray areas.
Right. So our mission today, looking at the Uniform Securities Act text, the NASA commentaries, all these study notes, is to figure out the actual why behind the rules. We are not just going to memorize flashcards.
No, because if you try to brute force memorize a list of exemptions, the exam writers will just invent a scenario you haven't seen before and you'll completely freeze.
Yeah, you'll panic.
Exactly. But if you understand the biological makeup of these rules, the philosophy of the law, you can basically diagnose any hypothetical they put in front of you.
So, to help us do that, let's introduce the cast of characters we'll be using to test these rules today. We have three fictional people who are going to make a lot of mistakes.
I love these guys already.
Yeah, they're disasters. First up, we have Broker Bob. Bob owns a broker-dealer firm.
Yeah.
He's the kind of guy who is always looking for an angle. He maybe cuts a corner here or there to save a buck and constantly tests the boundaries of the law.
Right, the classic corner cutter. Next is Clerical Claire. She is Bob's administrative assistant. She's the one from your opening story, actually. She just wants to do her filing, answer the phones, and go home to her cat without getting indicted.
A noble goal. And finally, we have founder Frank. Frank is a tech startup CEO. He's got that disruptive, move fast and break things energy. He is desperately trying to raise capital by selling his company's stock, and he firmly believes that bureaucratic rules just shouldn't apply to a visionary like him.
Oh, Founder Frank's going to get into so much trouble today.
So much trouble. So, armed with those three, let's try to define what actually makes someone an agent. I'm looking at the legal text here, and it seems to require three mandatory elements.
Yeah, I like to think of them as like the three strands of DNA. If a person is missing even one of these strands, they are not an agent.
Okay.
But if all three intertwine, the law slaps the agent label on them, and all that regulatory burden kicks in.
Okay. Lay out the DNA strands for me.
So strand number one, the person must be an individual. Strand number two, they must represent a broker-dealer or an issuer.
Right.
And strand number three, they must be affecting or attempting to affect purchases or sales of securities. So individual representing, affecting, or attempting.
I want to stop and poke at that first strand, the individual requirement, because it sounds almost too simple. The law specifies an individual, which in legal speak means a natural breathing human being, right? Not a corporation, not a partnership.
That is the defining line, flesh and bone.
So let me stretch this logic. Broker Bob knows that being an agent comes with immense personal liability. If he messes up, his personal record is dinged. So if you're listening right now, think through this with me. What if Bob goes to a lawyer, pays a few a few hundred bucks, and sets up a limited liability company, an LLC.
Okay, Bob's Trades LLC.
Exactly. Bob's Trades LLC. He routes all his client calls to the LLC. All the paperwork is signed by the LLC. Can Bob register that LLC as the agent so that the corporate veil protects him?
I mean, the regulators saw that loophole coming a mile away. The answer is absolutely not.
Not a chance.
Zero chance. An LLC is a business entity. It's just a piece of paper filed in a state office somewhere. The state requires agents to be natural persons for a very specific reason, and that reason is accountability.
Because you can't put a piece of paper in jail.
Exactly. You cannot put an LLC in jail. You cannot suspend an LLC's personal livelihood in the same way you can a human being's. In the securities world, the firm, the entity, is the broker-dealer. The human picking up the phone, the one actually speaking to the client, that is the agent.
Okay, so the state wants a human throat to choke if things go south.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
Oh, okay.
The firm is the entity, the agent is the human. That brings us to the third DNA strand, which I think is where the biggest exam traps live. Affecting or attempting to affect. The word attempting is doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
Oh, it is the single most important word in the definition.
Let's bring clerical Claire into this. Yeah. Let's say Claire is tired of just answering phones. She wants to prove to broker Bob that she has what it takes to be a top producer. Bob is out of the office. Claire prints out a list of cold leads.
Oh, no.
Yeah. She picks up the phone and calls 100 people, pitching them this hot new tech stock. But she is incredibly nervous. She stutters. She clearly doesn't know what she's talking about. And every single person hangs up on her. Zero sales. She didn't affect a single transaction.
Not a single penny changed hands.
Right. So did she trigger that third strand of DNA? She didn't actually do any business.
She triggered it the very moment she dialed the first number and made the pitch. She is an agent.
I understand that's the rule, but walk me through the why. Why is the state coming down on Claire like a ton of bricks when she was entirely unsuccessful? She didn't harm anyone's portfolio because nobody bought anything.
We have to look at what the Uniform Securities Act is fundamentally trying to achieve. It is a consumer protection statute, right?
Right.
The regulators aren't just trying to prevent bad trades from clearing. They're trying to protect the public from the behavior of being solicited by unqualified, untested people. The actual danger to the public happens during the pitch itself.
Because even a broken clock is right twice a day. If Claire keeps calling, eventually someone vulnerable might just say yes to a terrible pitch.
Precisely. If the law only regulated successful sales, a boiler room could just hire 100 unregistered people, have them make thousands of wild, fraudulent cold calls, and the state would only be able to punish them for the 3 or 4 calls that actually resulted in a sale.
Wow. Yeah, that would be a massive loophole.
Exactly. By penalizing the attempt, the state administrator can shut down the dangerous behavior before the financial damage actually occurs. The regulators, they do not care about your closing rate. They care that you are swinging the bat at all.
Swinging the bat. I like that. So attempting is the trigger. If you pitch, you are an agent. But what about the people who don't pitch, but they run the place? I'm looking at the notes on the C-suite here. The partners, the officers, the directors of a firm. Does having vice president on your business card automatically make you an agent?
It does not. The Uniform Securities Act uses a functional test, not a title test.
A functional test.
Yeah. Your business card is completely irrelevant to the state administrator. They are looking exclusively at your day-to-day function.
Okay, let's test that. Let's say Bob's firm has a chief compliance officer. Let's call him Compliance Chris. Chris is a partner in the firm. His name is literally on the door. But his entire job is sitting in a windowless room, reviewing trade logs, reading regulatory updates, and filing paperwork. He never speaks to a customer. He never touches a trade ticket.
Under the functional test, Chris is not an agent.
Even with his name on the door.
Even with his name on the door. He lacks that third DNA strand. He is not affecting or attempting to affect trades. His title as a partner doesn't just magically create that third strand.
But if Bob has a vice president of sales, who's also a partner, but she spends 4 hours a day calling hedge funds to pitch securities.
And she is an agent because her function involves the attempt.
Okay, functional test. That's super clear. But the sources mentioned this weird little shortcut for these C-suite folks. It says that if a partner or officer does act as an agent, the registration process is somehow different.
It is, yeah. It's a unique piece of administrative relief, but you have to be very careful with how you apply it. Let's say Bob's firm is registering in a new state for the first time. The firm itself has to go through a massive, highly scrutinized application process to become a registered broker-dealer in that state.
Right. Tons of paperwork.
Right. And during that firm-level application, the state looks very closely at the firm's leadership, the partners, officers, and directors.
So they are running background checks, looking at their disciplinary history, really vetting the executives.
Exactly. So because the state has already thoroughly vetted those specific executives during the firm's application, the law provides a shortcut. When the broker-dealer's firm registration is approved, it automatically constitutes the registration of any partner, officer, or director who functions as an agent.
Wait, really? They just ride the coattails of the firm's approval?
Yep. They don't have to submit a separate individual Form U-4 application.
That seems incredibly efficient, which is honestly rare for securities law. But I see a trap here. The rule explicitly says this shortcut is for officers of a broker-dealer.
Yes, it does.
So what about founder Frank? Frank is the CEO of his tech startup. His startup is an issuer, not a broker-dealer. If Frank starts calling venture capitalists to pitch his company's stock, does he get to ride the coattails of his company?
He absolutely does not. This shortcut applies exclusively to broker-dealers.
Really? Why the double standard?
Well, if you think about the underlying logic, it makes perfect sense. An issuer like Frank's tech startup does not go through the same intensive firm-level licensing process that a broker-dealer does. Frank's company isn't applying to be a registered financial institution.
Oh, right. They're just a software company.
Exactly. Therefore, the state administrator hasn't thoroughly vetted Frank's background in the same way they vetted Bob's executives.
So if Frank, as an officer of an issuer, is functioning as an agent, he has to register the hard way, fill out the paperwork, pay the individual fee, take the exams.
He has to go through the front door, just like everyone else. And the exam loves to test this. They will describe a scenario where the president of an issuer is selling stock and ask if their registration is automatically effective. It's a massive trap. Do not give issuers the broker-dealer shortcut.
Time out. Stop what you're doing. If you are walking your dog, look at me.
Yeah.
Or, well, listen to me. Do not give issuers the shortcut.
Okay, before we move off the core definition, I want to circle back to Clerical Claire for a second. We established that if she cold calls, she's an agent. But what if she stays in her lane? The law seems very protective of clerical and administrative staff.
It is, provided they strictly maintain their boundaries. Answering the phone, transferring calls to a registered agent, typing up meeting notes, filing compliance documents. None of that is affecting or attempting to affect a trade.
So if a client calls and says, "Hi, Claire, I need to buy 100 shares of Apple," and Claire says, "Sure, let me transfer you to Bob," she is completely safe.
100% safe. But what if Bob is at lunch? The market is crashing. The client is screaming, "Claire, just put the order in. Bob said you can do it." If she types that order into the terminal, just being helpful.
She has crossed the Rubicon. Taking a customer order, even passively, is legally defined as affecting a securities transaction.
Even if she didn't recommend it.
It does not matter that it wasn't her idea. It does not matter that she didn't recommend the stock. The mechanical act of accepting and transmitting a customer order requires registration. By being helpful, Claire just committed an egregious violation of the Uniform Securities Act.
That is the line right there.
Yeah.
You can route the human, but you cannot route the trade.
Exactly. I mean, it goes deeper than that. The state demands that the person taking the order has passed the requisite exams to understand what they are processing and is subject to regulatory oversight if the trade is mishandled. Claire is invisible to the regulators. They can't have invisible people touching the market infrastructure.
Wow. Okay, so we've established a very wide net. Attending to trade, taking orders, pitching it all makes you an agent. But the law isn't a monolith. There are carve-outs, right? People who get a pass. And looking at the research, the terminology here is incredibly frustrating. The regulators use two words that sound like synonyms: exclusion and exemption.
Oh, conflating those two terms is the number one reason people fail this section of the exam. They are not interchangeable at all.
Let's break them down mechanically. I want to build a better metaphor here than just a VIP pass.
Yeah.
Let's think about it in terms of a professional sport, let's say professional basketball. What is an exclusion?
An exclusion means you do not meet the definition of an agent at all. When we look at the three DNA strands, the law essentially says, in this highly specific scenario, we are going to pretend strand three doesn't exist. Because you are not legally defined as an agent, the registration rules simply do not apply to you.
So in our basketball metaphor, an exclusion means you aren't a basketball player. You are a vendor selling hot dogs in the stands.
I love that.
Yeah, the NBA's rules about dribbling or fouling don't apply to you because you aren't in the game. You are entirely excluded from the definition of a player.
That works perfectly. You are outside the regulatory perimeter of agent registration. Now contrast that with an exemption.
Right. What is an exemption?
An exemption means you are an agent, you meet the definition, you have all three DNA strands, you are absolutely a player on the court. But the state has decided that for this specific game or for this specific play, they are going to grant you a waiver from the registration requirement. You are an agent, but you are an exempt agent.
So you're playing in the game, but the referee has given you a special waiver that says you don't have to wear the official team jersey today. You're still subject to the rules of the sport, but you got to pass on a specific administrative requirement.
That is a crucial distinction, and it leads to the single most unbreakable rule in all of securities regulation, the anti-fraud rule.
Oh, this is the hammer.
It is the absolute bedrock of the Uniform Securities Act. Fraud is universal. The anti-fraud provisions apply to any person in connection with the offer, sale, or purchase of any security.
Let me test this with our metaphor. Let's say founder Frank has an exclusion. He is the hot dog vendor. He doesn't have to register. Can he lie to a customer about the financial health of his company?
No.
What if Broker Bob has an exemption? He is a player on the court, but he has a waiver for this specific state. Can he omit a material fact to a client?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so if you are listening to this, I need you to understand. Exclusion means you don't have to buy a ticket to the game. Exemption means you bought a ticket but got to skip the line. But no matter what, if you are in the stadium, you cannot punch the referee.
You cannot punch the referee. You can never, ever be exempt from fraud.
Got it.
And the exam will try to lure you into a false sense of security here. They will build a long, complex scenario where an individual is perfectly excluded from the definition of an agent selling an exempt security to an institutional buyer. And then they will ask, is this individual subject to the anti-fraud provisions of the Uniform Securities Act?
And the answer is always yes.
Always, unconditionally yes. You can be exempt from paperwork. You can be exempt from fees. You can never be exempt from fraud.
I love how definitive that is. It's one of the few black and white areas in this muddy landscape. So let's look at who actually gets to be the hot dog vendor. Who gets these exclusions? The notes here divide the world into two camps. Individuals representing issuers and individuals representing broker dealers. Let's start with the issuers. Founder Frank's camp. The exclusions here seem surprisingly broad.
They are broad, but we have to understand the economic logic behind why they are broad. A broker dealer's primary fundamental purpose is to affect securities transactions. That is literally how they make money. An issuer, on the other hand, is generally a normal business that occasionally uses securities to raise capital.
Okay, so Ford Motor Company's business is building trucks, not trading stocks. Frank's business is writing software, not trading stocks.
Exactly. So the regulators recognize that it would be overly burdensome to force the executives of Ford, or founder Frank, to study for a Series 63 and register as a broker-dealer agent just because they occasionally sell some company stock to fund a new factory. The state gives individuals representing issuers several major exclusions to facilitate capital formation.
The first major carve-out for Frank is the exempt securities exclusion. If Frank is selling a specific type of exempt security, he doesn't have to register as an agent. But looking at the list, it is heavily restricted. There are hundreds of exempt securities in the world, but only five specific categories trigger this exclusion for the human selling them.
Right. It is a closed universe of five. Number one, government securities, which includes U.S. federal, state, municipal, and Canadian government securities. Number two, securities issued by banks, savings institutions, or trust companies. Number three, qualifying commercial paper. Number four, investment contracts issued in connection with an employee stock, purchase, savings, or pension plan.
Okay, you just listed four distinct areas, though I know the statutes break the government ones into separate bullet points to make five. But the point is, it's a very tight list. Governments, banks, commercial paper, and employee benefit plans.
Right, and the exam writers know exactly how to exploit this list.
Let's talk about the traps, because I see them glaring at me. Just because a security is exempt from registration does not mean the person selling it gets an exclusion. The classic exam trap is credit unions.
Oh, they love credit unions.
Okay, listener, pay attention to this. Under the USA, a security issued by a credit union is an exempt security. The credit union doesn't have to register the shares it sells to its members. But if the president of the credit union is the one pitching and selling those shares to the public,
that president must register as an agent.
Why?
Because while credit union securities are exempt, credit unions are not on that magic list of five that grants the individual an exclusion. The security is safe, but the human is not.
That is wild. The bank president gets an exclusion, but the credit union president has to take the Series 63.
It seems arbitrary, I know, but you have to obey the strict letter of the list. The same applies to insurance companies and public utilities. Their securities are exempt, but the individuals representing those issuers to sell them must register. Do not let the exam trick you by conflating an exempt security with an excluded agent.
If you're listening, drill that into your head. Banks get the pass, credit unions, insurance, and utilities do not. Now let's deep dive into one of the most tested items on that magic list, commercial paper. This is an absolute minefield.
It is the ultimate test of detail retention.
Let's put founder Frank in a scenario. So think about this as you listen. Frank's software company is doing well, but he needs a quick injection of cash to cover payroll while he waits for some client invoices to clear. So his company issues commercial paper, which is essentially a short-term corporate IOU. Frank decides to sell this debt directly to some wealthy local investors. To be excluded from registering as an agent, the commercial paper he is selling has to meet three highly specific non-negotiable criteria.
I call it the holy trinity of commercial paper, though we should probably unpack why these three numbers were chosen by the regulators. So the three prongs are a maximum maturity of 270 days, a minimum denomination of $50,000, and it must be rated in one of the three highest rating categories by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization like Moody's or S&P.
Okay, 270 days, $50,000, top three rating. If I'm trying to memorize this, I need to know why. Why 270 days? That's 9 months. Why not just a year?
Because the regulators want to ensure this exclusion is strictly used for short-term operational financing, like Frank making payroll. Once corporate debt crosses the one-year mark, it begins to look and act like a long-term bond, which carries significantly more risk and requires full regulatory scrutiny. 270 days is a hard, bright line to prevent companies from funding long-term projects with unregulated debt.
Okay, that makes sense. Short-term cash flow only. Now, why the $50,000 minimum denomination? Why can't Frank just sell this paper in $1,000 chunks to whoever wants it?
Because of who the regulators are trying to protect, the everyday retail investor. If you are buying a single piece of debt that costs $50,000, the assumption is that you are either an institution or a highly sophisticated, wealthy individual who can fend for yourself. You don't need the state administrator holding your hand. If Frank were allowed to sell them in the $1,000 chunks, he could pitch them to grandma, and the state absolutely wants to regulate anyone pitching unregistered corporate debt to grandma.
So the high price tag is a natural filter to keep retail investors out. And the top three rating requirement is obviously just to ensure the company isn't on the verge of bankruptcy.
Exactly. It has to be prime quality debt.
So if you're listening right now, ask yourself how you'd handle this exam question. Frank issues commercial paper. It has a top-tier AAA rating. It is sold in $100,000 blocks. But it matures in 10 months. Does Frank get the exclusion?
He fails. 10 months is roughly 300 days. It breaches the 270-day maximum. The exclusion completely evaporates, and Frank is suddenly an unregistered agent committing a violation.
It's all three or nothing. They will give you two of the prongs and subtly alter the third. You have to lock in. 270 days, $50, top three rating. Okay, let's look at another issuer exclusion, the federal covered trap. This one breaks a lot of brains.
Oh, it breaks brains because it seems totally counterintuitive to everything else you learn about federal covered securities.
Right. Normally, if a security is federal covered like a stock listed on the New York Stock Exchange, state regulators have to back off. The federal government has supremacy. So it stands to reason that if Frank's company goes public and is listed on the NASDAQ, and Frank represents his company in selling that NASDAQ-listed stock, He should be excluded from state agent registration. Right.
That is the logical assumption, and it is completely wrong.
Explain this to me. Why is the state allowed to regulate the human if they can't regulate the security?
Because the Uniform Securities Act explicitly narrows the agent exclusion for federal covered securities. It states that an individual representing an issuer is only excluded if they are selling in two highly specific scenarios under the Securities Act of 1933. Transactions with qualified purchasers or private placements under Regulation D sold to accredited investors. Notice what is missing from that list.
Exchange listed stocks?
Exactly. The exclusion is limited to private, highly restricted capital raises. If Frank's company is publicly traded on an exchange and he is actively functioning as an agent by attempting to sell that stock to the public, the state says, look, we can't stop the stock from being sold, but we can absolutely require the human making the pitch to pass the Series 63 and register.
So the federal covered exclusion for agents is basically just for Reg D private placements.
Mm-hmm.
If Frank is quietly raising money from millionaires in a private offering, he's excluded. If he's pitching exchange-listed stock, he must register.
That is the exact distinction you have to memorize.
Let's bring Frank back down to earth for a minute. He isn't doing a Reg D offering, and he certainly isn't on the NASDAQ. He's just a guy with a startup trying to build morale. He wants to offer his existing engineers and developers the chance to buy stock in the company.
This brings us to a very common and highly tested exclusion, transactions with existing employees, partners, or directors of the issuer. The regulators want companies to be able to offer stock to their own workforce without jumping through impossible hoops.
But there is a massive condition attached to this, the no commission rule.
It is the absolute linchpin of this exclusion. An individual representing the issuer, like Founder Frank, is excluded from being an agent only if no commission or other remuneration is paid or given directly or indirectly for soliciting any person in that state.
Let's test the boundaries of remuneration. If you are listening, see if you can spot the violation here. Scenario A, Frank's normal salary as CEO is $150,000 a year. He walks around the office, pitches the stock to his engineers, and several of them buy in. He receives his normal paycheck at the end of the month. Is he excluded?
Yes. A standard salary, which he would receive regardless of whether anyone bought stock, does not count as remuneration for soliciting. He is safely excluded.
Okay, scenario B, Frank is highly motivated. He tells the board of directors, I'll take my normal salary, but for every engineer I convince to buy 1,000 share, I want a $500 bonus.
The exclusion is instantly destroyed. The compensation is now directly linked to the solicitation.
Let me push back. What if it isn't cash? What if Frank says, if I hit my target of selling 10,000 shares to the employees, the company buys me a new Tesla?
Still destroys the exclusion. The law says directly or indirectly. A Tesla is remuneration. It changes Frank's psychology.
Explain that psychology. Why is the state so obsessed with the commission?
Think about it from a behavioral economic standpoint. When Frank is just on salary, he might casually mention the stock plan to an employee. But the moment you introduce a commission, a bounty, or a Tesla, Frank's incentives align perfectly with a Wall Street stockbroker.
He's basically a broker now.
Exactly. He is now financially motivated to pressure, cajole, and aggressively pitch his employees to part with their money. The state recognizes that a commission transforms a casual internal offering into a high-pressure sales environment. If Frank is going to act like a broker, the state demands he be registered, tested, and regulated like one.
The bounty changes the behavior. That is a great way to remember it. If the exam question mentions a bonus, a commission, or a finder's fee tied to the sale of employee stock, the exclusion is dead. Frank is an agent.
Which naturally leads us to look at the other side of the aisle. We spent all this time looking at the broad exclusions for issuers like Frank. What about the professionals? What about individuals representing broker-dealers, like Broker Bob's agents?
Right. Earlier, we established that issuers get a break because it isn't their main business. So I'm guessing that because broker-dealers are literally in the business of selling securities, their exclusions are probably a lot thinner.
Thinner is an understatement. They are practically microscopic. If you represent a broker-dealer in affecting securities transactions, you are an agent, period. The exclusions are essentially non-existent, save for one incredibly narrow edge case.
Let's look at this edge case. The notes call it the federal de minimis exclusion, and it traces back to the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. It looks like it was designed to solve a very specific logistical nightmare for traveling clients.
Yes, it is. Imagine Agent Alice works for Broker Bob. Alice is fully registered in her home state of New York. She has a great client who has been with her for years. The client goes on a month-long business trip to California. Alice is not registered in California. The client calls from California and says, Alice, the market is moving. I need you to execute a complex option strategy right now.
If the law was completely rigid, Alice would have to say, sorry, I can't talk to you until you fly back to New York.
Exactly, which ultimately harms the consumer. So this hyper-specific federal rule allows Alice to conduct business with this temporarily traveling client without being registered in California, provided a grueling list of conditions are met.
Let's list the conditions, because the exam will definitely test them.
First, the broker-dealer firm itself, Bob's firm, must already be registered in California. The agent can't use this exclusion if the firm isn't licensed there.
Okay, firm must be registered. What's next?
Second, the client must be an existing customer. The rule specifically demands the customer has maintained an account with the BD for at least 30 days. You cannot use this to prospect new clients who are traveling.
Right. And a third.
Third, Alice specifically must have been assigned to this client's account for at least 14 days prior to the transaction.
30 days for the account, 14 days for the agent. It is so granular. It's clearly designed just to allow continuity of care for a transient client. Well, the agent perhaps files their paperwork to get registered in the new state. But beyond that unicorn scenario, agents representing BDs don't really have exclusions.
They do not. However, they do have a pathway to exemptions, which relies entirely on the status of the firm they work for.
Okay, we're back to exemptions, the way to play in the game. The core concept here seems to be inheritance. The agent follows the firm.
That is the golden rule. An agent has no independent standing when it comes to exemptions. They inherit whatever regulatory status their broker-dealer has. If Broker Bob's firm is required to register in a state, all of his agents doing business in that state must register. If Broker Bob's firm is legally exempt from registering in a state, his agents are generally exempt from registering in that state as well.
Let me make sure I fully grasp this, because there is a trap here regarding investment advisors. Investment advisors, under the Uniform Securities Act, have a de minimis exemption. If an IA has no place of business in a state and directs communications to 5 or fewer retail clients in a 12-month period, they don't have to register.
That is correct for investment advisors, yes.
Yes. So does Broker Bob's firm get that 5-client rule?
Absolutely not. There is no numerical de minimis exemption for broker-dealers. One single retail client in a state where Bob has no office triggers registration for the firm.
And because there is no 5-client rule for the firm, there's no 5-client rule for the agent. The agent lives and dies by the firm's status.
Exactly. Which means, to know if the agent is exempt, you must be a master of understanding how the firm gets exempt.
All right, let's build a new metaphor for this. Let's say Broker Bob wants to do business in Texas. Bob has no physical office in Texas. He doesn't want to pay the fees to register his firm in Texas. To do business there legally without registering, he has to possess one of two specific regulatory passports, and he cannot mix them up.
Let's explore these passports.
Passport number one is the corporate passport. The technical term is the institutional exemption.
Right. Under this passport, Bob can do unlimited business in Texas without registering, provided he deals exclusively with institutional clients. We are talking about banks, savings institutions, trust companies, insurance companies, investment companies, and pension plans with substantial assets, other broker-dealers.
Why does the state of Texas allow this? Why let Bob operate unregulated if he's dealing with massive sums of money?
Because of the sophisticated investor concept, the state of Texas assumes that the chief investment officer of a multi-billion dollar pension fund doesn't need the state administrator to protect them from Broker Bob. They have armies of lawyers and analysts to protect themselves. The state's limited resources are reserved for protecting retail investors' everyday people.
Which brings us to the catch. The word exclusively. If Bob is using the corporate passport, what happens if he signs just one single retail client in Texas, like a doctor, a lawyer, a school teacher?
The passport is instantly revoked. The firm loses its exemption. And because the agent inherits the firm's status, every single agent of Bob's firm operating in Texas is suddenly an unregistered agent committing a violation.
Wow.
Yeah. One retail client destroys the institutional exemption. Zero tolerance.
Got it. Corporate passport means strictly no retail. Now, let's look at passport number two. I call this a tourist passport. Mm-hmm. The technical term is the snowbird exemption.
This one is completely different, and it is explicitly designed to allow contact with retail clients, which is why people get confused.
So Bob has a client who lives in New York. The client retires and decides to spend 4 months a year wintering in a condo in Texas. They are a snowbird. Bob has no office in Texas, and he isn't registered there. Can Bob still call his retail client while they're sitting by the pool in Houston?
Yes. Under the tourist passport, Bob's firm, and therefore Bob's agents, are exempt from registration in Texas if they are effecting transactions with an existing customer whose permanent residence is in another state, but who is temporarily present in Texas.
Temporarily present. That is the operative phrase. How does the state define temporary? What is the catch here?
The catch is that the test is based on permanent residence, not the amount of time spent visiting. The client must maintain their legal domicile in New York. If the client decides they love the barbecue in Texas so much that they sell their New York home, buy the condo permanently, change their voter registration, and get a Texas driver's license, they are no longer a tourist.
They are a resident.
And the second they become a legal resident of Texas, the tourist passport expires. Bob now has a retail client who is a resident of a state where he isn't registered. But it has 30 days from the time the client changes their residence to either get his firm and his agents registered in Texas, or he has to close the account.
This is such a classic exam trap. They will try to confuse the rules of the two passports. If you're listening, visualize this. The corporate passport, which is institutional, allows an unlimited number of clients, but strictly zero retail residents. The tourist passport, the snowbird rule, allows retail clients, but strictly zero permanent residents.
Yeah.
If you mix up the rules, If you think the snowbird exemption forbids retail or the institutional exemption allows 5 retail clients, you will get the question wrong.
Keep the passport separate. It is the only way to navigate those scenarios.
Okay, so we've exhausted the exclusions and the exemptions. We've looked at every possible way to avoid doing the paperwork. But what if you don't qualify for any of them? What if you just have to bite the bullet and register? Let's dive into the mechanics of registration and what happens when things go wrong.
The mechanics are built on a concept we briefly touched on earlier, dual liability. Registration is not just the agent's problem.
It takes two to tango.
Hmm.
The Uniform Securities Act makes it illegal for an unregistered agent to transact business, but it specifically makes it a separate, distinct violation for a broker-dealer or an issuer to employ an unregistered agent.
It's a fail-safe mechanism. If Clerical Claire crosses the line and starts taking trades without being registered, she is personally liable. But Broker Bob cannot just fire her, throw his hands up, and say, I had no idea she was doing that.
Right. Ignorance is no excuse.
The state places an affirmative duty on the firm to supervise and ensure its agents are properly licensed. If Claire goes down, Bob goes down with her for employing an unregistered agent.
That dual liability creates a very rigid structural relationship between the agent and the firm, which brings us to my absolute favorite metaphor in securities law, the space station.
It is the most accurate way to visualize how agent registration actually functions in the real world. Many people assume that passing the Series 63 gives you a license that you carry in your wallet, like a driver's license, allowing you to just go out into the world and sell securities independently.
But that's not how it works at all.
Not even slightly. Imagine a...
This metaphor perfectly explains what happens during a job change. Let's put Agent Alice in a scenario. If you're listening, I want you to predict the outcome here. Alice is an astronaut tethered to Broker Bob's space station. It's Friday at 5:00 p.m. Alice gets into a screaming match with Bob. She quits on the spot, and she severs her tether. Now, Alice already has a signed contract to join a massive rival firm, Mega Broker, starting at 9:00 a.m. on Monday morning. What is Alice's legal registration status on Saturday and Sunday?
Her status is inactive. The very millisecond she terminates her employment with Bob, her tether is cut. She is free-floating.
But she's joining a new firm on Monday. Doesn't she get a grace period? Can't she call her best clients over the weekend and say, hey, I'm moving to Mega Broker, hold off on any trades until Monday?
She cannot. There is absolutely zero grace period in the Uniform Securities Act. When you are free-floating, you are legally invisible to the market. Any attempt to effect a transaction, even just soliciting a client to move their account over the weekend, is a violation. Her registration only becomes active again when she officially associates with Mega Broker, submits her new paperwork, and the state administrator formally acknowledges the new tether.
The lack of a grace period is a massive exam focus. The test will offer you tempting answers like, she has 30 days to transfer her license. It's a lie. It is instantaneous.
Which brings us to the logistics of the breakup itself. When Alice cuts the tether with Bob and attaches to Mega Broker, who is legally responsible for telling the state administrator that this happened.
I call this the ex-boyfriend rule.
Yeah.
It's like a high school breakup where the drama is so intense that every single person involved has to individually text the principal to confirm it happened.
That is exactly what happens. The law demands triple notification. All three parties involved in the transition must promptly notify the administrator.
Party number one, the agent. Alice has to notify the state that she left Bob and joined Mega Broker.
Party number two, the old employer. Broker Bob has an affirmative duty to notify the state that Alice is no longer under his supervision. He has to formally detach her tether on his end.
And party number three, the new employer. Mega Broker has to notify the state that they are accepting Alice and taking on the liability of supervising her.
If any one of those three parties fails to promptly notify the state, it is a compliance violation. The exam will give you multiple choice options, trying to convince you that only the new firm has to file, or that the agent's notification covers the old firm. No, all three must notify.
Now, what if Alice doesn't want to break up with Bob? What if she just wants an open relationship? Can Alice be tethered to two different space stations at the same time? Dual registration?
It is technically possible, but it is heavily restricted. An agent can represent more than one broker, dealer, or issuer, but only if the state administrator's rules explicitly authorize it, and more importantly, only if both broker dealers fully consent to the arrangement.
So Bob and Mega Broker both have to know about it. Both have to agree in writing to share liability for her, and the state has to rubber stamp it.
Yes. If Alice tries to secretly moonlight at Mega Broker on the weekends without Bob knowing, she will be sanctioned, and both firms will likely terminate her.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We've dissected the DNA of an agent, we've walked through the exclusions for issuers, the passports for broker-dealers, and the rigid mechanics of the space station tether. Before we leave you, let's lock this in with a rapid-fire recap of the top five testable takeaways. If you're going to take the exam tomorrow, these are the five concepts you must not forget.
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Takeaway number one, the attempt.
Right. The law regulates the pitch, not just the close. Attempting to affect a trade makes you an agent, even if you are terrible at it and never make a single sale. The consumer protection kicks in the moment you solicit.
Takeaway number two, the issuer employee.
Founder Frank can sell stock to his employees without registering, but only if he isn't paid a bounty to do it. A regular salary is fine, but the moment a commission, bonus, or Tesla is tied to the sale, the exclusion is destroyed, and he must register.
Takeaway number three, the commercial paper trap.
To exclude the agent, commercial paper must satisfy the Holy Trinity simultaneously. A maximum 9-month or 270 days maturity, a minimum $50,000 denomination to keep out retail investors, and a top 3 rating. If it misses even one, the agent must register.
Takeaway number 4, the tether.
Agents do not have independent exemptions, they inherit them from the firm. If the firm loses its institutional exemption by talking to a single retail client, every agent in that state instantly loses theirs as well. The astronaut follows the space station.
And takeaway number 5, the messy breakup.
When an agent changes firms, there is zero grace period. The transition requires triple notification. The agent, the old firm, and the new firm must all promptly notify the state administrator.
Unbelievable deep dive today. But before you take out your earbuds, our expert has a final provocative thought. We spent the last hour treating the Uniform Securities Act like a sacred text, but the world is changing faster than the law can keep up.
Yes. And this is something I want you to genuinely mull over as you study. We spent a lot of time today emphasizing the first DNA strand. An agent must be an individual, a natural person, flesh and blood. You can't put an LLC in jail. But look at what is happening in the fintech sector right now. Broker-dealers are rapidly deploying highly advanced conversational AI voice bots. These bots can cold call prospects, analyze portfolios, and verbally pitch investments. They are literally attempting to affect securities transactions.
Which is the exact behavior the law regulates.
Exactly. But a bot is not an individual. It has no flesh and bone. So technically, the bot cannot be an agent. If the bot commits fraud or aggressively solicits an unsuitable investment, who is legally on the hook? Is the software developer the agent? Is the firm's CEO the agent? The Uniform Securities Act was written in the 1950s for a world of traveling salesmen. As AI begins to autonomously swing the bat and pitch the public, the regulatory framework is going to face an existential crisis. How do you regulate a boiler room when there are no humans in the room?
That is a fascinating legal black hole. The space station is deploying drones, and the tether rules might not apply. Something to keep your mind spinning while you're grinding through those cert fuel practice exams. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Keep analyzing the why, watch out for the traps, and we will catch you next time.